Hello, and welcome to episode 13 of the City of Man podcast. This is Edward Song. Today's episode is entitled Civility, Toleration, and Smugness, and was inspired by a pretty widely discussed article on Vox entitled The Smug Style of American Liberalism that was published back in April. The link for that article should be available in our show notes at christianhumanist.org. We actually recorded this episode back in the beginning of May, but haven't been able to post it until now. So with that explanation, we hope that you will enjoy our discussion of the challenges of American political discourse and the alleged smugness of liberals.
You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of the City of Man podcast, a show which tries to examine politics from the vantage of traditional Christian conviction. Representing progressive evangelicalism, I am Edward Song, an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. And with me, as always, representing conservative evangelicals, is Coyle Neal, an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Coyle, how goes it today?
It's going well. Our semester is finally over. Will have been over for a couple of weeks by the time this drops, so it's nice to be able to relax a little bit. How about you,
Ed? Things are good. My grades are all in. Here we are. We're recording episode 9. I'm curious, Coyle, whether have you ever done any podcasts before you started this one?
I have never done any podcasts before I started this one. Episode 1 of City of Man was my first podcast ever. How about you?
The same. And so I'm wondering whether anything about this whole enterprise, including just the making of the making of the podcast itself, and then including our conversations with each other, whether anything has surprised you or what have been the most interesting things about this experience?
I'm a little surprised at how exhausting it is to record an episode. And that's not a reflection on you. I think that's probably more that I'm sort of naturally a lazy person. And sitting down and talking about something for, you know, hour and a half, however long we end up doing it, that I actually have to think a lot about. That I'd forgotten how difficult that can be. It can be that way, of course, in the classroom, but in general, this is just a lot more work than I thought, which is not to say I'm not enjoying it. I certainly am. How about you, Ed? Any surprises from the podcast world?
Yeah, I mean, there are superficial things. Like, so I do the editing, the audio editing for our episodes, which means that
I am very grateful for, by the way.
Which means that, I listen to us a lot. I listen to us more than any other person on the planet, maybe. Which means that I listen to my own voice, and I hate the sound of my own voice. You know, does your voice sound the way that you expect it to when you listen to recordings?
No, I hate the sound of my own voice, too. And I'm sure there are people out there who are like, yeah, I also hate the sound of your voice.
That's right. I would say, I rather like the sound of your voice. But I guess there's some biological explanation for why it is that our voices sound different.
Well, I would imagine it sounds different because when we talk, we hear it.
Yeah.
But, you guys can't see it, but I'm pointing at my ears and my mouth at the same time.
That makes good radio.
Right. I do have the face for radio, so I guess there's that advantage. Better podcasting than what's the name for doing it on, like, YouTube? Vlogging, is that right?
Something like that. I don't know.
I'm a stodgy old conservative. I don't know all these fancy technical terms.
I rather hate that. But I'm not surprised by the amount of work that goes into it. I mean, some are easier than others, so like some of our episodes are sort of straight out of my classes, and so it's easy for me to
Right.
sit down and talk about things.
Right. I don't mean the prep work so much. I mean just the idea of sitting down, like the actual sitting through the podcast, thinking deeply for an hour and trying to be articulate about it. That's exhausting for me.
Yeah. It's so hard. I suppose some people naturally have this gift, but trying to be articulate is just, and doing these episodes, it's like
it's shocking to me how inarticulate I am in trying. And like when you're teaching a class, it's like you can get things wrong, and you can try to say the same thing a few different times until eventually you get it right, you know? And in this format, it's a little bit harder to do it. You sort of want to get it right the first time. And when you're talking about very challenging, very abstract things, that's difficult to do. You know, one other thing that has been beneficial for me is that, I've certainly learned a lot about conservatism in the last few weeks, and feel like my appreciation for what conservatives believe has deepened immensely. And, you know, maybe especially the making vivid the grievances that conservatives have has been helpful for me. There was something when we were talking about the conservatism episode where you're sort of making a point about popular sovereignty and, you know, these small communities of people feeling put upon by these broad outside forces. That was helpful for me in sort of seeing the point that way. Not that I don't feel like there's a pushback against that. So much, I think, of the conflict between conservatives and liberals just arises out of the fact that, you know, we increasingly live in these very siloed media worlds, social worlds, in which the voices that we hear are ever more like our own. And in some ways, the voices that we hear, the loudest voices that get heard, are those that are sort of to the outside of our respective positions, right? So we are always becoming increasingly radicalized in various different ways. And that makes it really increasingly difficult to sort of appreciate the point that the other person is making and the concerns that weigh on them. And not being in a position in which the concerns of the other are vivid to you just leads to all kinds of confusion.
Yeah, and the internet was supposed to be the thing that fixed some of that, right? It was this great place where all these different ideas could come together and bounce off each other and coalesce, and it would be this great place of tolerance and openness. And the reality is people go to the websites that they agree with. Mm-hmm. And they go to read people that are saying what they want to hear, and then they turn around and shout that. And every time someone does that, that side gets a little bit louder, but they don't hear anything from the other side.
Yeah, that's right. And then the next person to come along who wants to get heard, they need to go to the outside of that last person. And so it really does lead to this kind of this feedback effect. And then, you know, the person who was previously heard in radical, that point of view and the way that it was said becomes normalized, right?
Yep.
Because, and so everything gets ratcheted up in particular kinds of ways. Not that we were planning this, but this leads into our topic for the day, which has to do with tolerance and civility in American culture, maybe especially in American political discourse. But this is something that we wanted to talk about today. And I don't know if you remember this, Coyle. You wrote the introduction on that very first episode. And, you know, what you wrote about... Well, so let me preface this just by saying that civility and tolerance in discussion is a little bit a part of our mission statement. Like, one of the things that motivates the desire to do this podcast is having two sort of committed political theorists, both evangelicals, but one progressive and one conservative, trying to hash things out and have an extended and deep conversations about a lot of the issues that divide us, but in the context of civility and mutual respect and listening. And I think we've been relatively successful in that. You know, in that first episode, you said something that was, you wrote this, and so it was particularly striking to me when you read it. I don't know that I had seen it before. But in that first episode, you said, I guess that I'd like to see, in addition to Christians thinking well about politics, I'd like to see us actually talking well about it also. I think we all have a tendency to demonize those we disagree with before we actually hear what they have to say. When we do this, we not only ignore the true things that they have to say, but we tell a lie about God's character. As Christians, we were God's enemies and he died in our place. Will we really not even listen to to those we disagree with politically, if our answer to that is no, I think we have to ask whether or not we're really believers in the first place, which is a pretty punchy thing to say.
Now, does that count as us just reading stuff we already agree with? Like, are we just feeding into that cycle now by quoting ourselves on our own podcast?
Well, look, just because you quote yourself on your own podcast, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's necessarily a bad thing. Feedback loops can be good things, I suppose.
Well, yeah, I'm an academic. I quote myself all the time.
Do you sign your own books and articles?
No, I have not. None of my students would want to read the stuff I write.
I think I have once, but it was relevant. But anyway, only once on a academic topic that we were discussing that was related to one of my specialties. But anyways, so that was like, you know, a really punchy way to put the point. And I think tolerance and incivility is a great toxin in our public life together. I mean, it leads to very real conflict and even very real violence. It frustrates our ability to tackle the big problems in life. And if all of that isn't bad enough, it's like particularly bad for Christians insofar as it spoils our witness to the world. And for reasons that I won't go into, sort of the issue of civility has become like a really big deal for me in a lot of ways. I mean, in part maybe due to the podcast, in part just to do some other things, like almost an existential kind of an issue for the church, just because I think, you know, we do political discourse in this country badly, and Christians are heavily implicated in all of that. So I think this is an important topic for us to try to tackle. With all of that said, you know, I also think it's super important that there's a kind of civility that I think is a bad kind of civility. The kind of civility in which we don't want to disagree with each other. And it is this kind of tricky thing insofar as, on the one hand, where it's really important for us to listen to each other and to treat each other civilly and respectfully, to really sort of try to get in each other's heads and try to sort of think, what really motivates that? But at the same time, we're sort of trying to hammer down and get at the truth of the matter. And so the paradox of that process is that, you know, it's sort of about vociferous engagement with the issues, which might lead to vociferous arguments and vociferous disagreements, but all done within the context of, I got to really make sure I understand this as well as Coyle does. And I really need to make sure that I listen and make sure I understand what he's saying, even while we try to, because, you know, both of us are diehard in our views. But that does lead to a kind of a paradox.
Right. So the two criteria are you have to be talking to someone you disagree with. Mm. I mean, it doesn't really count as being civil if you're only talking to people that you agree with anyway. Mm. Not that you can't be mean to someone you agree with, but in terms of political discourse, the conversation between Republicans and Democrats or conservatives and liberals, that's what needs to be civil, not so much the in-house conversations. That's less of a general concern. And then you need to actually listen to what they're saying. So responding to what they're saying and not the caricature of what we think they're saying.
Mm-hmm. And be willing to be convinced.
Yeah, you know? Sure.
Yeah. But anyway, so with all of that probably overly long preamble, why don't we sort of kick things off and try to wade into our topic today? Cool, you want to kick us off with sort of a little introduction to the issue of tolerance and civility as you see it?
Yeah, so sort of probably useful to start with a short historical kind of intro to where we're at. And I know I'm leaving stuff out of this because I am not a historian of tolerance or anything like that. So if you're listening and I've missed something that's just critical, please, please email us, drop a note on the Facebook page or the blog or whatever and let us know. But from what I understand, in the modern world, the tone of civility, the tone of tolerance, is largely set by the Enlightenment. So the Enlightenment thinkers argue that, you know, we ought to disapprove of what someone says, even while we defend to the death their right to say it. I think that gets attributed to Voltaire, but I think that's one of those things he actually didn't say. So that seems to be kind of in the culture, in the ether, particularly in the political and philosophical ether, this idea that the standard is we respect what each other has to say, even if we ultimately disagree and ultimately go different ways. It doesn't mean there's no passion, doesn't mean there's no heat. It means that you are still at least willing to talk. Obviously, there are times, there are places, there are individuals when that principle doesn't rule the day in political discourse. But largely, I think, in the Western world, people have sort of accepted that or had sort of accepted that. That starts to change in the United States in the 50s and 60s. So all sorts of social, political things going on in the 50s and 60s on both sides of the spectrum, both on the right and on the left. On the left, you have a thinker who is by and large the philosophical father of the New Left, a guy named Herbert Marcuse, and I have no idea if I'm saying his name right or not. Marcuse was one of the students of Martin Heidegger, who came to the United States in the early 1930s. He is basically the seminal philosopher of modern progressivism, one of the major figures who breaks the New Left away from the Old Left. From what I understand, he's mostly unread today, other than by the occasional scholar who's interested in the topic, but he was a major influence in the 60s. Marcuse argues that this old Enlightenment view of tolerance has become stagnant and even dangerous. He says that we've broadened tolerance out to the point where it has functionally become intolerance. So what happens in Congress or in legislatures or in society as a whole is we let everyone have their say, and then the majority goes ahead and does what it wants. So that tolerance becomes sort of a safety valve that lets pressure off for the minority that otherwise would be out, you know, starting a revolution. Well, now the majority can say, look, you had your chance, you didn't convince us, so we're going to do what we want to do. So tolerance actually becomes repressive. And I think the name of this essay is Repressive Tolerance. I don't remember off the top of my head, but we'll put it up in the show notes. So tolerance should be, according to Marcuse, a means of allowing criticism and dissent. When that criticism and dissent sort of collides with the majority opinion, you have to hammer out some kind of compromise or even have the criticism and dissent carry the day. That, in turn, leads to historical progress. It's a sort of very Hegelian view or very Marxist, depending on which route you want to take there. That's what he says should be happening. Tolerance, instead, has become the means by which the tyranny of the majority oppresses the minority and holds the status quo in place. It becomes the defense of evil rather than the promotion of good. So when Marcuse argues this, what starts to happen on the left, at least, is that a new view of tolerance begins to develop. This new view has two components. First, tolerance is increasingly focused on the fringes of society, where criticism happens, where particularly extreme criticism happens, rather than on the middle, who are, if you want to think of it this way, the mainstream of society are the people who actually need to be tolerant. They're the people that we need to say, hey, you need to respect what those fringes are doing. Well, that focus starts to shift outward, sort of like you were talking about with the internet. The focus starts to be on these outermost boundaries, as that's where sort of the important part of tolerance goes on. And the second thing that he argues is that tolerance ultimately exists for its own sake. Tolerance is about the promotion of social good, but the social good that it's about promoting is tolerance. This starts to shift the leftist worldview, where instead of tolerating those on the fringes as sort of a matter of traditional liberal rights, it becomes a matter of celebrating how important they are in society, since the fringes are the means by which social progress happens. This ultimately becomes a new definition of tolerance, and anyone who refuses to join in the celebration of those fringes, even if that person is still tolerant in the older sense, well, that person is hateful and is fair game for being shut down. On the right, you have something similar, and this is getting into that new right, the neoconservatism that in our conservatism episode I said I don't know as much about. It certainly kicks off with the McCarthyist movement in the 50s, this idea of communists as being so inherently dangerous that their mere existence cannot be tolerated, and they have to be sort of hunted down at all costs. That doesn't go anywhere, obviously, beyond the 50s. But you have the idea sort of percolating that there are groups of people who ought not be tolerated. Whoever those groups are, you're going to have different opinions from different conservatives, but that hangs around, again, sort of on the fringes of conservatism. At some point, the new right begins to move sort of towards the new left, I think probably with this idea from the 50s kind of hanging around of it's maybe not communism anymore, but there's still someone out there who's inherently dangerous that we need to not allow to have a voice, that we need to shut down when we can. I don't know if there's a key figure or a key moment when that happens. I suspect the talk radio folks are probably involved, which would situate it in sort of the late 80s, early 90s. So by the time we get to the 90s, we have two political parties that not only don't agree with each other in practice, that's always been the case. They now can't even dialogue because they no longer have the vocabulary to do so, and they no longer have the willingness to do so. Ed, that's sort of my quick overview of what happened. Anything to add to that? Any pushback on any of those points?
Yeah, so that's a very complicated story.
Sure.
I think the first thing that I thought about when we were getting ready for today's episode was a book that James Hunter wrote in the 90s called Culture Wars.
Mm-hmm.
James was actually my wife's dissertation director at UVA, so he is somebody who we know. That thesis, when it came out, the book was published in 1991. The thesis was very controversial. In part just because commentators about it, they always read the title, but they don't always read between the covers, right? And so there was a sense that Hunter was like celebrating the culture war like it was a good thing. And there's also a kind of a sociological debate as to whether or not there really are these fixed cleavages within American society. But, it's really interesting now, to more than 25 years later, sort of like the culture war thesis has borne itself out in spades. And the thesis really is that, so he's writing this book it comes out in 1991, 1991 looks like the land of milk and cookies compared to where we are now.
Right. The differences between Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush are functionally non-existent compared to the differences between, Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz.
Yeah. So we're getting Clinton v. Trump.
Right.
But part of what's really interesting about that book is that so one thing that he wants to say is that the story, so you sort of start the story in the 50s and 60s, and certainly, the cultural upheaval that we experienced in those periods, especially with regard to the fight for civil rights, the sexual revolution that followed, Vietnam, all of that, all of that fomented all kinds of cultural upheaval. One of the points that Hunter makes is that, in fact, the roots of the cultural conflict is very, very old. There have always been historic divisions in the country. He talks a lot about, conflict between Protestants and Catholics, and it's in the 19th century, or
sure.
fill in the blank, Jews. That was a particularly ugly period in a lot of ways. It's easy to sort of forget.
Right.
So one of the interesting things now is that we get this, these new cultural alliances that are formed between conservative Catholics and Jews and Christians, right? And that's a kind of a cultural alliance which would have been unthinkable not very long ago at all. But part of the point that he wants to make is the roots of this cultural division are very, very old.
Right. So you have conservatives in the 50s, late 50s, who are concerned that John F. Kennedy is too Catholic. And then conservatives in the sort of early 2000s who are concerned that John Kerry isn't Catholic enough.
Yeah. And that's only going back to the 50s, and we can go back
right.
much, much, much longer.
Sure.
Just the big point there was that that cultural story, it's easy to sort of look at our present moment and think that it's, I do think that it's importantly different in ways, but it's easy to sort of forget how ugly things were at other points in time and how our present social and cultural moment is rooted in things that go very, very deep into American history. I wonder, Coyle, if you think there is a limit to what we should tolerate, whether there are some things that are just out of bounds.
In what context? So, I mean, I assume things like murder are not on the table, right?
Yeah, look, how about racism or white supremacy?
Yeah, so I think, again, we have to start with the rule that tolerance is only tolerance if you're tolerating something you disagree with. So the fact that I disagree with racism and white supremacy is not automatically a reason to say we shouldn't tolerate them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do they meet a criteria that that in for reasons other than that they ought to not be tolerated? I don't know that I would say they do. You know, if there were a group of anarchists who were meeting in the local town, who were meeting in my town, I don't think I would be in favor of having them run out of town. Right?
Yeah, I suppose there's a little bit of a question about, like, what does tolerance imply there?
Yeah, so...
And it's also important to make a distinction between the right of free speech, say.
Right.
So, no progressive is saying that... nobody, I think, is saying that people should be thrown in jail for the things that they say, so long as that those things that they say aren't themselves, like, threatening acts of violence against other people. So one thing is that I think it's important that we distinguish between, say, rights, legal rights of free speech. It's one thing to say that we want to throw people in jail for what they think and believe. So, there's a big difference between thinking that a neo-Nazi white supremacist should be thrown in jail for what he wants to say and whether or not I think he should be allowed to speak on my campus, for example. So drawing a distinction between whether or not I think they have a legal right of free speech. And so, you know, and then I would say so long as they're not advocating or promoting violence against other persons, it would be a violation of their rights of free speech to impinge on their right to say that. But that's different from whether or not, I think we should invite them, give them a voice on our campus.
Well, right, and even then I would want to say that on your campus, because you're a private Christian college, yeah, of course, you guys can sort of control whoever you want. But a state university, if we're assuming that public free speech that they've got, and I guess this is just a case where I'm more of a civil libertarian than you are.
Mm-hmm.
I would say if the university is a public institution that opens its doors to the community, then there needs to be a process by which they have the same sorts of access that other community groups have, so long as they're not actually attacking anyone at their assemblies or meetings or whatever. The people who are reprehensible to us morally have the same rights and liberties we do. There's an interesting case, and I guess I would even say, in terms of advocating violence, I think I'm probably enough of a civil libertarian that I would even say that's okay as long as it's not specific violence against specific individuals. I think there's even a Supreme Court case about that. So it's Brandenburg versus Ohio, where you have this local leader of a Klan who is giving this speech and says something to the effect of, we're going to go get those people. And, of course, it's the Klan, so everyone knows exactly who he means.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets arrested by the state of Ohio. Susan says, my First Amendment rights have been violated. And the Supreme Court basically says, yeah, you're right, because you didn't target any one person, because this speech was so general that it is protected by the First Amendment. I think I agree with that, which is an odd thing for me to say about a Warren Court decision. But another example. There's a case of a guy named James Bell who's one of the early pioneers of hacking in the early days of the internet. Wrote an essay called "Assassination Politics," wherein he argued that there needed to be some kind of lottery set up to determine on what day politicians would be assassinated. And then in his essay, he included a little thing that said, you know, if you're the one doing the shooting, you'll know exactly what day it's going to fall on, so you'll know what day to bet on, and you'll win the lottery. That was then published on the internet, which raised the question of, is that beyond the pale for free speech? Mm-hmm. His defense for that was that will actually make our society more democratic, because politicians would never dare to speak against what the people want, because it would be literally endangering their lives. I believe that gentleman is currently in jail. I think it is for tax evasion, not for publishing that essay. So what do you think, Ed? Am I too flexible here in my libertarianism? Not what do you think about shooting politicians? I'm assuming we're both against that.
I'm against that.
Good. I would be nervous if you weren't. But am I?
I don't know that I understand that second case, but the first case seems a little crazy to me. I mean, so there doesn't seem to me to be a lot of difference between me saying any good American would go out there and get Coyle Neal, right? And me saying any good American would go out there and get, and I'll fill in the blank, like encouraging violence against actual people.
Well, and it's been a while since I've covered this decision, but I think the distinction is how likely is it actually to happen? So, you know, if Donald Trump goes on TV and says, you know, Coyle Neal is an enemy of the United States, that could have, you know, very personal, real-world consequences as a result that are, you know, somewhat likely. If he goes on TV and says, you know, we've got to get all Muslims out of this country by any means necessary, it's harder to see a direct connection between the speech and any individual action, or even that there will be any individual action at all as a result. Does that make sense? Now, I'm not necessarily defending it. I'm just saying that from a legal perspective, punishment in that case is a more difficult thing to justify.
In the second case?
In the case of sort of vague violent speech as opposed to specific targeted violent speech.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously, it's significant and important with regard to how likely the threat is, but it's really easy, like your perspective on how vague the threat is going to vary depending on whether or not you are one of those people who are in that category.
Absolutely.
So if at a Klan rally, somebody says, we need to go get these people. These African-American people in our town, we need to get them. Like, I mean, free speech is a really, really important right. But no right is absolute, and no right is absolute, right? And rights can bump up against other kinds of rights. And then we need to make evaluations with regard to, like, how significant they are. And the right of free speech, while extremely central and important, to me sort of pales in comparison over and against the right of people to life and security.
So I agree with that, I think. But I would want to know what you mean by life and security. So I think I would agree that if a speech... And I guess we've transitioned a little bit away from tolerance into speech, but yeah. I think it's all related. If a speech leads to physical violence, mm-hmm. right? I think, and if you can sort of demonstrably show that that is going to happen, then I think there is maybe a legitimate space for intolerance there, and maybe I'd even say between our two perspectives. That's a compromise I would be willing to make, even if I still tend towards giving free speech the benefit of the doubt. But what do you do with something like emotional violence? Or this person is saying something I don't like, and that makes me feel insecure, even if there are no actual physical repercussions to that. Are you in favor of shutting down that kind of speech also?
Yeah, so, I mean
that's really the question today, right? No one's trying to defend the Klan anymore. Now we're asking.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that we're so free and clear of all of that. But let's talk about what you want to talk about.
Right. It's no longer on the front page of anything. Right. It's now the question of if I'm a college student at a campus, I'm
the
a college
swastikas,
student. On...
The swastikas appeared at that college campus recently.
Yeah, was that in Georgia?
I can't remember.
I don't remember where that was either. This has been several campuses lately. If you follow the college news, so is hanging Donald Trump posters on your state college campus hate speech to the Muslims on that campus, to the Muslim immigrants on that campus? Should that be not a speech that is not tolerated because it's so sort of emotionally traumatic?
Yeah. So no, obviously. Sorry, when you said hanging Donald Trump, I thought you meant like a doll of Donald Trump hanging in effigy.
Oh.
And so I was a little bit confused about why that was going to be a threat.
No, yeah, hanging Donald Trump posters.
No, so obviously not. Swastikas, though. Yes, right?
Yeah, again, I'm as morally offensive as that is, if it's not leading to physical violence...
Uh-huh.
You're willing to say I'm still okay with shutting that down. You find out the local Nazi party is having a meeting in your town. You go to the city council and say you need to stop this.
So a couple. So I mean, what if there is a white supremacy student group that just wants to hang these posters at swastikas?
And they're like an actual legitimate student group?
Yeah. Like.
Yeah, I think I'm really glad I'm not an administrator having to make that call, for sure.
Yeah,
I don't know. What do you do? Would you let him hang him up?
No.
No? What would your grounds for not doing so be?
So, again, we make this distinction between the legal right of free speech.
Yes.
And what we're willing to tolerate as an institution.
Yes.
And... But I will say that, like, you know, I do, a lot of progressives actually are exercised by worries about constraints on free speech in universities, colleges and universities around the country. Like, you know, a lot of progressives are very exercised about that. Progressives of a more civil libertarian strain.
Right.
And so you will see a lot of progressives making the exact same kinds of arguments that conservatives make about. And I, you know, I'm torn. I worry about that too. And in some ways, free speech, while there's a difference between the legal right of free speech as a political right.
Sure.
And, but I mean, the university is a unique kind of institution precisely because it is predicated on the exchange of ideas.
So yeah, we can broaden that out a little bit and say the local white supremacist group is meeting in your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Do you go to your local whatever governing authority is in charge of your neighborhood and have them run out? I mean, is that, or do you say, look, free speech, freedom of assembly, I don't like what you stand for, but I have to put up with that.
If there were a mechanism by which any group had to have the approval of the neighborhood, and that's just a mechanism.
Right.
And I would say, no, not here, buddy. Not in my neighborhood. Go somewhere else. If you want to go somewhere else, then that's fine. You have that legal right. But assuming that there's a mechanism in my neighborhood in which we get to make decisions about that kind of thing.
Sure.
Then I think, you know, we can draw a boundary. You know, so recently, one of the reasons why this whole civility issue is increasingly on my radar is that a couple weeks ago, the Republican Club... You know, I don't know if it was the Republican Club or the Young Americans for Freedom.
Right.
Maybe it's the case that the Young Americans for Freedom, like, that's not a student organization. But anyways, they brought Ben Shapiro to our campus.
This is Shapiro, the Daily Wire guy, right? Daily Caller, Daily Wire.
You know, he used to write for Breitbart, but he resigned in the wake of when they threw that reporter under the bus.
Right.
Remember the Trump on the... The claim that she was attacked by the Trump campaign manager.
Right.
So he left Breitbart in the wake of that. But he writes for those sorts of outlets. And increasingly, he's doing the college campus tour routine. And there was a lot of consternation on campus about bringing him. And I think a lot of the student conservatives were sort of like, look, this isn't fair. This is a violation of our free speech. And it's kind of funny because, like, we're an evangelical college.
Yeah, I was going to say, that is totally, totally different set of rules for private colleges.
Well, yeah, but you wouldn't think that a Christian college is typically the kind of place that's hostile to political conservatives.
Right.
But there was all of this talk. And then when he himself got here, the first thing that he did was sort of call out the college for making the visit so difficult. But, like, my whole thing with him, so he's very inflammatory, that sort of thing. And it was this big talk on microaggressions and tolerance and diversity and white privilege, you know, sort of on all of those things.
Sure.
And, you know, I actually didn't disagree with everything that he said. But he was so inflammatory and insulting students and making fun of administrators. And, like, my point about that was, look, the college is nervous, and ultimately we did invite him. But, you know, the college was nervous about having him, not because of his views, but because he was a jerk, right? And he was a jerk to people. And you're right, the context is a little bit different because we're a private Christian college that is particularly exercised about civility. And now I can't remember why I started down this road.
You were talking about why, why it's such an issue.
Yeah, and but I mean, educational institutions have particular kinds of I think they have particular kinds of responsibilities to engage in ideas, but to engage in ideas in a particular kind of environment.
Right.
And again, this is a, you know, there's a difference between legal rights, free speech, and what this particular educational institution wants to do. And the situation for a private Christian college is different than it is at a big public university.
Sure.
But even at big public universities, you know, the aim is promotion of certain kinds of dialogues. And so certainly if you just want to sort of censor somebody who you disagree with politically, that's one thing. But if you're less enthusiastic about having somebody because they habitually insult people or groups of people, that to me is a different kind of a thing.
I mean, I think we obviously have some advantages, and even aside from the college question, but on the civility and tolerance question, we have advantages when we're thinking about this just by virtue of being Christians, right? I mean, we, unlike most other people in society, when the white supremacist or the black supremacist or whatever person with views that I find morally abhorrent moves into the neighborhood, we still have grounds and even orders to talk to them. And be civil to them, and represent Christ and his kingdom to them. It may be that in that case, true civility is pointing out that their beliefs are offensive to God.
Mm-hmm.
But civility is still not being a jerk back, right?
Civility is
if you see them with a flat tire, you stop and you help them change it, or if you know that they're in the hospital, you take them a home cooked meal or whatever it is that your culture does. I don't know what the rules are in Santa Barbara, but whatever it is that civility looks like, you do that for that person, however terrible their beliefs are. And if that's true on the extremes, it's certainly true in the middle, right? It's certainly true when we're talking liberals and conservatives or Republicans and Democrats or whoever else. Christians, I think, have just such an advantage that we don't often think about or take advantage of, because we do have this idea of, in God's eyes, I am no better morally than this other person, and it's just grace that saved me, so I should be kind to him because God has been kind to me. I think that's probably all I've got on Christian civility.
Yeah, that's right, and that point is helpful. So even if we wouldn't want to invite somebody to a college campus, there is this question about what it is to treat them civilly. and respectfully, and to sort of, and to honor them, even though we might think that they're deeply, deeply confused about something, but honoring them nevertheless, and recognizing the fact that they too are children of God, made in God's image, and that they too have an extraordinary kind of value.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing.
Yeah, and I think even colleges have tools that they can use, even if they don't tend to think of them, for those sorts of situations. So what do you do with the student, you know, who wants to form the white supremacist group? Like, do you give them permission to form and let them hang their literature around campus like you do all of these other groups? There are still tools that they have at their disposal. So that's when you have the panel discussion and you say, you know, we will let you speak so long as you agree to hear the other side out. Now, again, like private Christian college, that's not how that works so much. But state schools, again, marketplace of ideas, all that sort of thing. There are tools. There are ways to encourage civility by setting the example yourself, even institutionally. I've seen Christian colleges that have had organizations that are opposed to what they stand for ask for a chance to address the students, and you have some Christian organizations, of course, Christian colleges, of course, who say no, and that sort of creates a big PR opportunity for the group. Other Christian colleges that say yes on the condition that a couple of our faculty get equal time, so we'll mm-hmm. it'll be after hours in the evening, we'll have this big forum. We'll invite the community. You'll get 20 minutes. We'll get 20 minutes, and then we'll throw it open to questions. So there are ways to do that, right? There are ways to engage without endorsing, I guess, if that makes sense, and to do it in a way that's sort of respectful of the humanity of everyone involved, even if you disagree with the opinions. Now, would you do that with the white supremacist? Man, that's so far out there, it's hard to say. Other than I'm glad I'm not an administrator.
Yeah, so, I mean, that is a bit of an outlandish example, but it could have...
I'm sure it happens. I mean,
for sure.
It certainly
happens.
Sort of
looking at the extremes teaches you something about how you can approach non-extreme examples.
Right.
In some ways, the idea for this episode sprung from a Vox article that was relatively widely circulated on the smug style in American liberalism that was written by Emmett Renson few weeks ago in April. Cole, you want to talk about that article and look at liberal smugness as an example of incivility in American political culture?
Yes. Particularly since I think we had different reactions to it. I didn't completely agree with the article, in part, of course, because the assumption, being a Vox article, is that liberalism is correct. And smugness ought to be toned down so that the good news of liberalism can be spread more. So in that sense, I didn't agree with it. I also don't think I agreed to, and maybe you disagree with this, but it seemed like there was an undercurrent in the article that the left is losing. Like this smugness is costing them at the polls. This smugness is damaging the cause overall. That's just not what I see going on in culture at all. I mean, I see sort of the left ascendant and triumphant and the right in retreat across the board. But maybe that assumption is not there in the article. I mean, am I reading that wrong?
I don't really have a strong view about that.
Okay.
I mean, I don't disagree with that, but I didn't necessarily get the sense of it.
Yeah, so basically what the article is arguing is that in the liberal mind, of course, they have the truth, right? They know what is true and what is good for the country, particularly when it comes to the poor and the middle class. So from the liberal perspective, a poor or middle class person who is conservative or votes Republican is basically voting and thinking against their own interest, which raises the question of why is that person doing that? And the answer that this article argues liberals have come up with is they must be ignorant. And then they have, you know, polls and studies and, you know, quote-unquote science that confirms this, that then gets magnified through media and the internet, through Facebook memes and through Twitter and through all of the echo chamber that we now have. The the persistent conservative refusal to see these clear truths then leads to a sort of disdain of the left for the right and for those very poor people that they had originally claimed to be trying to help. This then gets reinforced by an in culture that grows around these known facts and generates a thought pattern based on the idea that it's not just something we believe, it's something that we know. It's you ignorant peasants out there who are the problem. All of that so far, the author says, that's sort of always been there with the liberal elites. But because of technology, because of social media, it's become definitive sort of top to bottom rather than just incidental on sort of the upper class of that movement. And he gives several examples. He says, look at the left's reaction to Kim Davis, the utter dismissal of anything that she might have had to say, any conscience, any sort of genuine religious conscience that she might have had, as being either empty or actively evil, or the left's response to George W. Bush, for that matter. Where Renzin argues that W. was really just sort of playing it up in a Machiavellian style. The left could not get it through their heads that maybe he wasn't what they thought he was. Maybe he wasn't just this moron from the South who was, the son of a president and Ivy League educated and all of that, but still clearly a moron because he's conservative and because of the way he speaks. It then assumes that the left, from this sort of position of smugness, then assumes that the solution is education. Until that point, it's mockery, but ideally, education is going to be the solution and sort of presentation of the facts. And when I was reading that, I was like, man, if as a conservative, I'd say if that were true, there would just be no liberals out there, because once you get the facts, of course, but then we're into conservative smugness instead of liberal smugness. As sort of a side note to that, that mentality, that idea that education is the solution, I think is pervasive kind of systemically in our country. I don't think that's just a leftist thing. I think you have that on the right as well. I see that in my own students. To some extent, it doesn't matter what social, political, moral problem I ask them to, offer a solution to on a test. The answer is always the solution is education. And I'm like, but you realize if you're educating a bad person, you're just educating a bad person, right? There's not necessarily a moral change, but somehow this idea has got built into our culture. From that point, the author goes on to say that since the left has sort of split from much of its poor working class base, it has largely abandoned the care for them that it once had, which has led the poor to turn to the right for morality purposes, for sort of traditional purposes. Even if the left still has their economic interests in mind, which again, that would be a point of disagreement on my side, they by and large have flocked to the Republican Party. All of this ultimately results in the possibility of cooperation between people who disagree. You cannot cooperate with someone that you think is ignorant or evil. It undermines some of the things that liberals think they want, like helping people, and in fact may lead to the exact opposite. You may actually be harming people once you're trying to help someone that you have come to disdain. So that's sort of the summary of the article. Ed, did I miss anything there?
No, I think that's a pretty terrific summary, actually.
So what do you think about that? I mean, this is by a liberal on a liberal site targeted at liberals.
Yeah.
There, as I've said as I was going through this, there are things I disagree with. What are your thoughts on it? Especially that idea of we know the truth, and if only people saw these facts that we have, they would be on our side. You agree with that? Do you disagree with that? What do you think there?
Yeah. So I hated the article. But not necessarily because I disagree with the big claim. I mean, I do think that certainly a lot of liberals I know sort of are kind of smug. What does that mean exactly? I guess that means sort of a self-satisfied confidence that I know better than you. Something like that? Is that what it is to be smug?
Yeah, I'm right, and you're too ignorant or too stupid to see that. So I'm going to treat you as if you know, you're a child or you're evil. I think is sort of what I got from the article.
Yeah, and so certainly I know, you know, I know a lot of liberals who are smug. I've been accused of being smug recently, even. Let's set that aside. You know, so, but part of the argument is that there's something, like, essential to the nature. Well, I mean, a couple things. I mean, one of the claims is that, maybe this gets at the point that you were getting at earlier, that, like, the reason why liberals aren't doing better is because we're turning off the white working class by our smugness. That's a part of the article.
Which is the main concern, right? The main practical concern of the article.
Yeah, and I like, that's crazy, I think. I mean, the it makes this point about how support by the white working class has declined. Democratic support for the white working class has declined. In 1948, it says 66% of manual laborers voted for Democrats, along with 60% of farmers. In 1964, it was 55%. By 1980, it was 35%, right? So the idea is that it declines. And he's like, you know, that's because of it. It's this attitude of smugness that is turning off. And, like, that's insane. I mean, all of that happened because of the Democratic embrace of civil rights. Right, and so you've got this huge churn in the allegiances of large portions of the populations of the various parties, right? And so all of those conservative Southern Democrats who were for segregation, you know, Strom Thurmond, they all left the party and they all became Republicans,
right? Among other things, right? So you also have the Vietnam War. That was a very Democrat war that drove people out of the. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, but certainly civil rights was a huge part of that.
Sure.
Right. That just led to this remarkable transformation in the makeup of the two parties. It's not because liberals are smug, though I think liberals can be smug. And I think that conservatives can be smug.
Oh my gosh, can we ever?
But, you know, so one thing I think that's interesting about it is that, though, you know, certainly conservatives can be smug. Liberals, this is what I'm going to say, but I think the objectionable public characteristic attitude of conservatives, I wouldn't say that it's smugness. I would say that it's self-righteousness. So I'm not saying that all conservatives are self-righteous.
Now, how do you distinguish those two things?
In a kind of a... So smugness is, I know better. I'm better educated than you. You don't understand the facts. Self-righteousness, I think, is I'm better, you know, I'm morally better than you.
Right.
You are morally craven.
Right, so sort of the Newt Gingrich... going after, because I've been reading this Barney Frank biography, Newt Gingrich trying to get Barney Frank thrown out of the Senate for basically sexual deviance, so moral deviance, because Frank had come out as a homosexual, while Newt Gingrich was going through his divorce or about to carrying on an affair with a staffer, right? Yeah. So that sort of self-righteousness, that idea of I am better than you, often contrary to reality. Is that fair?
Yeah. And I think, like, those attitudes are characteristic of the motivating worldview of conservatives and progressives. But you know, so I think liberals can be smug. I don't know that it's an essential feature of liberalism that it's smug. Certainly liberals can be smug.
Yeah, and I'll go ahead and throw in here. I think conservatives can be smug also. I think that it is a different kind of smugness, especially as we are sort of increasingly distant from the seats of power in the culture and politics and so on. I think it's more and more a sort of Schadenfreude kind of smugness rather than the sort of thing that we're seeing on the left. And I'll use myself as an example here, and I guess this counts as public confession, if not as much repentance as it maybe should be, but at least confession. The water crisis in Flint, Michigan, right? So the issues they're having up there. My initial response to that, and I think the responses of a lot of conservatives out there, was, you know, that's a city that's been run by liberals for who knows how long, in a state that's been run by liberals for even longer, getting no help at all from the liberal in charge of the government. It's getting exactly what it deserves. Let them drink lead, and maybe eventually they'll learn. I think that response is wrong on sort of two counts. I don't think anyone's going to learn anything. And it's obviously not a response in line with Christian charity, right? There is something wrong with that as your approach to politics, apart from whether or not you're right. That is a different question than the attitude in which we sort of engage with the other side, right? Maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. Smugness is really never justified. Is that fair enough?
Yeah. So certainly there can sometimes be Schadenfreude of that kind. Again, like when I listen to Hannity or Rush Limbaugh or O'Reilly, I would say that the characteristic kind of attitude is one of self-righteousness.
Sure. Well, I guess if smugness, self-righteousness is a problem, and tolerance is the thing that we think is a good thing, how do we pursue that? How do we become tolerant and fight against being smug? I think ways not to be smug in politics, and these are reminders to myself because I am a very, very smug person. But things that we can do or things that I say we should do, even if I don't do them myself. First, we have to cultivate humility. That means being willing to admit when we are wrong. And it means being willing to lose. So there are times in politics we will not get our way as much as we might wish we did. That's not inherently a bad thing. We need to be able to say, yes, I tried to do this thing I wanted to do and I lost, and that's okay. Maybe I'll win next time, maybe I won't. Second, we need to listen to the other side. That means actually listening to them, not just assuming that we already know what they're saying. That means listening to what they're saying and not sort of filling in the blanks with what we already believe about them. And it means giving the maximum charitable interpretation to their words, so that when they say something that's true, we can say, hey, you've said this thing that's true. And if they say something we disagree with, we're trying to be sure that we're giving it the maximum possible spin, the most positive possible spin. And then we pursue, sort of actively pursue tolerance of those people we disagree with by being willing to be friends with them. I don't know if it's possible to be a truly tolerant person if you don't have any friends who have a different worldview from you. Now, ideally, you would be a liberal raised in a conservative part of the country or a conservative raised in a liberal part of the country. Obviously, we have no control over where we're born, but that's sort of my experience has been the most tolerant liberals are the ones who grew up in deeply red states, and the most tolerant conservatives are the ones who grew up in deeply blue states, possibly just because they sort of had to be by training. I don't know what the causality is there. Regardless of where you grew up, if you have no friends who have a radically different political worldview than you, your claims to be tolerant, your claims not to be smug are, I think, inherently suspect. Ed, anything to add to that?
No, I mean, I think that's all great. And you know, that latter point that you made sort of gets at the way in which people tend to be siloed into views that are exactly like their own. And it really is so true. There's all this amazing new social psychology research that sort of points out the ways in which it's so hard for us to sort of really appreciate somebody else's view unless we're in a position in which we can sort of empathize with them. I mean, you aren't in a position to empathize with them unless you're in a position to know them and to listen to them and to appreciate the things that, you know, appreciate the things that they say. So unless you know progressives, if you're a conservative, unless you know progressives, it's so easy to misunderstand or caricature or fail to understand, like, the point at the thing that they're getting at. in the abstract.
Yeah, I'll obviously even escalate that and say, unless you know them and like them personally. Mm. Right, so it's not enough to just sort of read the material.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then it's impossible to sort of genuinely appreciate the view of another person, like, wholly in the abstract. And there's always going to be this tendency to caricature their argument, even a little bit. You know, like I always tell my students, it's not like you can have a worked out view about everything. But if you're really invested in something and you think it's really important and you're going to be loud about it when you talk about it, you've got to understand that position as well or better than the person who holds it. Like, you really do. And then even on top of that, it's like, and when you articulate the view that you think they have, they have to nod their head and say, yeah, that's what I'm committed to. And it's so easy for people to sort of manufacture these positions that, like, aren't the positions that people in fact hold. And then you're just jousting at a straw man and failing to sort of engage, right? You need to engage, like, as you said, the maximal charitable interpretation of another person's view.
But the straw man is so much easier to beat it. Like, why shouldn't we take the easy route here?
Exactly. And we all do that. And it's so important to do that. And always sort of enter in with the kind of humility in which you're like, I might be wrong about this. I'm pretty sure that I'm right, but I might be wrong. Yeah, so I mean, I think all of that is great. And then I'll just conclude by just adding on, because the person who you're talking to is a creature who is made in God's image and is beloved by God, right? And so to treat that person disrespectfully is to desecrate something that has immeasurable value, right? It's like slashing a beautiful painting or, you know, defiling something that is holy and sacred. Like, we are all of us, even the people who we think of as our enemies. So, like, imagine the political figure who you most disagree with. That person is sacred in ways that you can hardly appreciate. And so to disrespect that person is to disrespect the image of God. And there are going to be cases in which it's going to be impossible to successfully engage with another person. And then the key there is to try to charitably disengage with them, right? Not every political conversation, not every political disagreement
with that. Right. We should strive, and I guess this will also sound smug, but we should strive to have those circumstances be on the other person and not on us, right? It should be because they're unwilling to be civil, not because we're unwilling to be civil. Mm-hmm. Which sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. Again, we're none of us perfect.
Yeah, and I think just as like a little test that you can always apply is like when you're discussing, you know, when you're talking about another person, like, are you talking about like their view or are you talking about their character, you know? And that's something that I've been thinking about just myself in terms of like I always try to in some way sort of like abstract the person into a view and talk about the view and not talk about the person. And even in some ways, this is just like a little trick, but even going switching from the second person to the third person, instead of saying, like, you believe, but it's more like this view, that, blah, 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 I think is an important way to sort of focus on the content of the belief as opposed to the person who holds it. Because it's so easy to sort of slip into, like, oh, well, you only think that because you're an idiot.
Right? Sure.
Or because you're morally corrupt. But with all of that said, let me remind everybody that the City of Man is a part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Please do check out all the other podcasts in the Christian Humanist Radio Network family. There are so many of them that there is doubtlessly one for you, including our own. To get more information about our podcast or any of these other podcasts, please do visit ChristianHumanist.org. Please also visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. Like our page. Give us reviews on iTunes. We would appreciate all of that stuff. If you want to shoot us an email, you can reach us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. And so on behalf of Coyle and myself, let me remind everybody, to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking,